could you tell me how this project originated, how you went from your first film to this one?
Yes, absolutely. Basically, I was touring my previous film, The Friendship Village, which, you know, recounts the story of U.S. Army vet's journey from war hero to peace activist and the reconciliation project he created when he worked with the Vietnamese general who had killed his whole platoon. And I was touring that through California and was invited to come to an event at the Veterans of Foreign Wars post there, the VFW post.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked to say something as sort of a representative of Canada, so I mentioned the fact that Canada had provided safe haven during the Vietnam War for people that didn't want to fight in Vietnam. And to my surprise, the whole room, including, you know, American vets, stood up and cheered. And I was really moved by this and started to really think about what Canada's role in that war had been. And to think about, you know, sort of researching a story about the Americans that came to Canada at that time, because as you're probably aware, it's estimated that more than 50,000 American men and women came to Canada as a result of their resistance to the war in Vietnam. So just a few weeks into working on that, I read in one of our national papers that Jeremy Hinsman, the first American conscientious objector to seek refuge in Canada during the Iraq War, had arrived in Toronto, and it just sort of hit me, wow, history just came full circle. And I contacted him and his lawyer and started following the current story rather than doing a historical piece.
Mm-hmm.
And went to Toronto, met with him. By that time, a second war resistor had filed a refugee claim, and his name was Brandon Huey. And and along the way, more and more people came, and I wound up profiling four of the many soldiers that I met.
What, obviously, there's a difference between what happened in Vietnam and what's happening now in terms of there being a draft and there not being a draft.
Yes.
Does that affect how you personally feel about people who seek refuge in Canada?
It doesn't affect how I feel personally about it because, you know, a soldier's right to their conscience is a human right guaranteed under international law, under the Nuremberg Code of the UN Charter. And, in fact, is, you know, even in the Code of Military Conduct under the U.S., where, you know, if a soldier becomes a conscientious objector, they're supposed to be able to file a CO claim that's evaluated and, you know, if they're determined to be a bona fide CO, then they can either do non-combatant duties or get a discharge. That's not always how things happen. And I guess what was challenging, particularly for Canadian audience, is this notion of an all-volunteer military. And because the film was made primarily for Canadian television, I realized that this was a big piece of the kind of pre-history, pre-war history in terms of these people's personal stories.
Mm-hmm.
That needed to be addressed, because certainly here in Canada, and I would imagine in the United States, people are a lot more sympathetic to someone who's sort of drafted against their will and their conscience to go fight in a war versus someone who, you know, with all kinds of information, enlisted voluntarily.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what people in Canada really are unfamiliar with is, you know, why it is that people, you know, the multitude of reasons that people in the United States, young people in particular, would join. And, you know, what I discovered along the way is that a lot of people, particularly in middle America, you know, these smaller towns where there aren't a lot of job opportunities and educational opportunities, and, you know, here in Canada where we have universal health care and that's not available in the United States, it's not always for altruistic reasons that people enlist. Often it's because they want to go to school or they need health care and things like that. And this really calls into question the notion of all volunteer. And so that's why I really looked into why each of the four soldiers I profiled joined. And I have found on successive viewings of audiences and feedback that we got through the TV broadcasts in both Canada and the U.S. that people were quite shocked to learn what happens to someone when they sign on the dotted line. And, for instance, in Jeremy Hinsman's case, his CO claim was reportedly lost. And so he resubmitted it, was sent to Afghanistan, and ultimately his claim was turned down. And then when he came back stateside, his superior officer allegedly handed him an envelope with the original CO claim in it, and things like that. So, you know, it would sound like that had been mishandled, although I was unable to get any interviews with people at Fort Bragg to confirm this. And in the case of someone like Brandon Huey, you know, he was promised a signing bonus when he enlisted, and this was a big enticement for him. Well, when he started asking for the paperwork to fill out to get the signing bonus, he was told that he should be more focused on his duties than getting money from the military, things like this. So, and in the case of the two soldiers in the film who actually went to Iraq, Joshua Key and Kyle Snyder, I mean, Kyle Snyder in particular fits the profile of the typical recruiting target in that he was a street kid who, you know, did his high school equivalency at Job Corps and literally claimed that the minute he got off the stage from claiming his diploma, there was a recruiting officer there that struck up a relationship with him. And in Josh's case, you know, he now has four children at the time. I believe he had two or three and just needed some kind of security. I mean, you know, a lot of these kids grew up in towns, as I say, that, as Jeremy Hinson's mom put it, you know, a good job in Rapid City is $10 an hour, and it's, you know, it's pretty hard to raise a family on that.
Right. Now, I wasn't clear about this from the film. Two of the people you profiled went to Iraq, one went to Afghanistan, and one did not go overseas, is that correct?
That's right. Brandon Huey never deployed.
Okay.
He deserted on the night of his eve of his deployment.
And only one filed a conscientious objector. Is it a petition? Is it a paperwork?
It's called a claim, a CO claim. And yes, and it's interesting that other American soldiers that have since come to Canada, when they get here, they're surprised to learn that there's something called conscientious objection. And when they learn what that is and that they could have applied for it potentially, you know, that's not information that's made readily available to soldiers for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. So they really have to dig around. And if you want to know, you know, what my personal interest in making this film is, my own husband, who's from Port Byron, was an officer in the United States military, mm-hmm. his lieutenant, and he filed to be recognized as a CO. And, you know, his experience is quite instructive because it wasn't even wartime. It was sort of the end of the Cold War. He was stationed in Germany. Mm-hmm. And his superior started opening his mail. He was taken away from his troops and almost went to prison because no one was recognizing his claim, and so he refused to put on his uniform as a way to sort of draw attention, like, please, you know, read my claim, I'm a CO, and never actually was recognized as a conscientious objector after 2 years mm-hmm. of trying to do this, and was ultimately let out of the military in a troop reduction program. So when he returned stateside, the Gulf War started, the first war in Iraq, and he started working for the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors to try and help other soldiers who, for reasons of conscience, didn't want to kill, you know, give them an opportunity to help them with their cases. And of the 171 cases he worked on in that context, only one was ever recognized as a CO. So it's a very hard status to achieve in the United States.
Are there larger statistics? You know, does the Army offer statistics on percentage of claims filed, how many are granted, how many are denied, those kind of things?
I would imagine they have some such statistics. I never had any calls returned by the Pentagon, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The Pentagon wouldn't talk to me, nobody.
In the film, the Canadian position on a broader question of what to do with these, I guess, refugees was still open. Is that still an open question in Canada, in terms of general policy? I know these are decided on a case-by-case basis, but is there...
Right. That certainly hasn't impacted general policy. What has been the challenge in the case of the American soldiers is that, well, first of all, the obvious one is the political relationship between Canada and the United States. And as a result of that relationship, when it's come to the legislative opportunities here in Canada for these soldiers to make their case, in fact, the Canadian Parliament has passed two motions to let the war resisters stay in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been legislative actions to sort of just get them some kind of status here in Canada where they can stay. And, you know, that was voted by a majority of the Canadian Parliament. So it's the government of the day, the Harper government, and the Immigration Minister, Jason Kenney, who've made this a particular cause of theirs, that they want to deport the soldiers for political reasons. Within the courts, one of the challenges is that the refugee claimants were never able to argue the war's legality, because if you look at international law, if you look at the UN Charter, if a war is considered illegal, then an order to, you know, following orders in that war would be considered an illegal order, and a soldier would have a right to resist, as per Nuremberg, when it was determined that Nazi soldiers, even if they were just mere foot soldiers, should have exercised their consciences when it came to following the kinds of orders that went on during World War II. Well, obviously, this is a much different context. It's our number one trading partner, and it's never been the evidence about the war's illegality, namely that the UN Security Council never sanctioned it, which by international law standards makes it illegal in the eyes of the international law, because they were never allowed to argue that in court. This is the basis on which they've been able to make appeals, that they weren't given a full hearing. And so it's made its way all the way up through the federal courts and to our Supreme Court. And now it's been, the Supreme Court refused to hear it, and now it's gone back down to the federal courts, where, a judge determined that, no, indeed, they didn't get a fair hearing. And so it's still making its way through that. At the same time, you have soldiers who have received deportation orders in spite of the fact that there hasn't been any kind of legal closure to their cases. And yet, because they're kind of in a no-man's land as far as their refugee status and the legal proceedings, soldiers are being deported by our by our government.
So when the Supreme Court in the United States, if the Supreme Court refuses to hear a case, the last ruling stands, basically. Is that the same as it is in Canada?
No, it's not. It just hasn't gone up to the, you know, they determined it wasn't a case for the High Court, so in fact that it should be dealt with at the legislative level. So basically what you're seeing here is just a volleyball match between the legislative branch and the judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody really wants to be the one to say that the war in Iraq is illegal and that Canada's not going to support, is going to really make that case and give war resistors refuge here. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious what the political ramifications would be with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been more politically expedient to just leave it to the courts until now. But because of, because almost 70% of Canadians actually support American war resisters staying in Canada, their political representatives have passed these motions that are being ignored
mm-hmm.
by the Prime Minister.
The four people you profiled, what are their statuses? Are they still in Canada?
They are still in Canada. Jeremy Hinsman is last I switched, and he's actually awaiting deportation. It's because his case was the first through. It's gone back and forth up down the judicial line, kind of thing. And he's, as soon as he hears a determination as to whether his case can be appealed on the grounds of the international of the illegal war issue, which is probably unlikely, then he and his wife and two children will be deported. So he's received what's called a pre-removal risk assessment, wherein determination has been made that he's not a threat, that if it's determined that he should be deported, then he would go willingly. And so he's just in limbo. Part of that status when you're in pre-removal stage means that you can't work, so it's been very hard because he's lost his work permit as he sort of awaits the outcome of this. Mm-hmm. Brandon Huey fell in love with a woman from Quebec, and they've gotten married and had a child, and so I think he's probably going to be able to stay here.
Because of his family relationship?
He's married to a Canadian, yes. But the same is true for Kyle Snyder. They didn't have a child, but they got married. But, you know, while one sort of case is wrapping up, the refugee immigration claim, and the other is starting, which is, you know, to become a landed resident through marriage, they're vulnerable. So I think Kyle's all right. I think Brandon's all right, but remains to be seen. And in the case of Joshua Key and his wife and four children, they're still living in Canada. And Joshua, because he did witness some things that may well qualify as war crimes, he's had a stronger case going mm-hmm. through the courts. And so in his case, it's still making its way through.
Mm-hmm.
And he may well, on the grounds of what he refused to do on the ground in Iraq, be allowed to stay in Canada. But, you know, the test case is definitely Jeremy Hinsman's, and at this point it's not looking good.
Your work ended up being a little less than an hour, was intended for television.
That's
what
right.
What sorts of things did you leave out that you wanted to get in?
I really would have loved to have heard from, you know, the military, the Pentagon, you know, I tried to make a balanced film because I think it's a very complex issue. That was a big disappointment to me. But otherwise, I think we did a pretty good job of packing it all in to 55 minutes. All the important things. And I just would have liked for it to have had a different ending. But as yet, the story's unfinished. So it ends as it ends, which is with all these people still in limbo. And that remains true today.
When you've shown it to people, what sorts of what have the biggest criticisms of the film been from people you've shown it to?
That's a good question. I've actually been surprised at how people have embraced the film. I thought it would be more provocative and more controversial, given the subject matter. And actually what I found is that when people really hear the reasons why these soldiers made the decisions they did and took the course of action they did, they're actually quite sympathetic. Even people who were, you know, very supportive of the war. I was even surprised when I would go down to small towns, you know, like where you are, sort of middle America, people very patriotic, and a lot of their kids are over there, you know? This is where the soldiers tend to come from. And I even found when I would, you know, I interviewed people on the street to sort of just get a sense of, you know, what was happening in the United States in terms of the popular support or lack thereof. I was very surprised at how many people were just like, well, you know, I don't know what they've seen over there. I don't know what they've done. And they would kind of give their conscience the benefit of the doubt. So,
mm-hmm.
in principle, I found people on both sides of the border to be pretty on side with the soldiers. And in fact, because of, you know, things not going so well in Canada, you know, there's a movement on in the United States right now to call on the Obama government to, you know, give them some kind of pardon.
The one thing I was unclear about from the film, there's some claim that these people face the death penalty if they come back, and then there's another claim that basically says they face 5 years in prison or something, relatively small number of years. I know that it's a long time still, but it's different than the death penalty. What is the penalty? What penalty do these four specific cases face? Do they face criminal charges?
Yes. I mean, on the books, right, the maximum penalty for desertion in a time of war is death. The death penalty hasn't been, you know, brought in since I think World War II or something. So, so that outcome is unlikely, but it is, you know, nevertheless as far as it could go. Soldiers who went to prison already, people like Camilo Mejia, things like that. Generally, they've been getting a year, which is, pretty reasonable. I think, I mean, you know, some would argue, well, it's wrong to go to prison for a day for exercising your conscience, and other people would say, well, that's a fair outcome. So it's really up to audiences to decide how they feel about what's happened to them. I've just tried to sort of give a fairly wide spectrum of experiences, you know, mm-hmm. looking at four different people and their backgrounds and their reasons, you know, and looking at the privates, right? This is about the grunts. This is about the people who have to carry out the orders.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important to look at is, you know, what is an individual's responsibility in a time of war when the international community has determined that the war they're fighting in is illegal?
Mm-hmm.
That's a tough question. And everybody has to answer that individually. It's, you know, between them and their God, right? And so it's, you know, for me, it's a matter of respecting that. And in some cases that happens for soldiers, and in most cases it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. To people who think these four people are cowards in some way, do you allow for that as a reasonable... I mean, I know you disagree with it, but do you allow for that as a reasonable conclusion?
I certainly allow for that as a reasonable emotional response, you know, particularly for someone who might have someone deployed overseas, you know. Why should, you know, that person get to exercise their conscience and my kid has to go on their third tour, you know. That makes a lot of sense to me on a personal level, on an emotional level. Unfortunately, on a rational and legal level, these people have every right to their consciences. And, you know, I think a more difficult question is, you know, why don't they, if they're standing up for their principles, then why don't they go to prison for them? And I think that's a more reasonable question to ask.
And that's where I'm going with it. I don't think it's cowardly to have exercised their conscience. Obviously, leaving the military carries with it a significant amount of risk, but if they felt so strongly about this, you know, the first thing they need to do is file a CO claim. If that's turned down...
They're aware that that's a possible course of action, which you should know most soldiers aren't, but yeah.
Right, and if they get screwed, you know, if the government's basically screwing with them, or if the military's screwing with them, you know, to pursue that, but eventually...
Well, that's the problem, though. They don't really have legal recourse within the military. And that's why some of them have come to Canada to argue it in the courts here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, for those that are more aware, or, you know, a little older, maybe a little better educated, and realize that they have rights that they need to fight for. So, I think, you know, it's a very complex issue as far as the, you know, the cowardly thing. You know, all I can speak to, you know, because that's an emotional reaction, all I can respond to that is in terms of the soldiers I do know, and that I've come to know for the last 4 or 5 years, and, you know, each of those individuals that are profiled in the film, I think it would be hard to call any of them cowardly. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to leave behind the country you love,
mm-hmm.
all your family, all the people you've ever known, and embark on a new life because something inside you says this is wrong. That takes a lot of courage. So I don't really find their actions cowardly. I just question what's the most useful way of exercising.
Mm-hmm.
Exercising those rights.
Have you asked each of them directly why they just don't face prison? I mean, then I'll phrase it in a... I'd like you to answer that question, but I'd also like to know, I mean, if you can put it to them. I mean, they've at this point, your film was made in, what, 2005, 2004? Was when you,
2006.
Well, it was when was it filmed?
We finished filming in March of 2006. We were on Fort Bragg.
Okay, so...
Fort Hood, yeah.
So it's been, you know, for these guys 3 to 4 years of uncertainty, whereas potentially they could have been, you know, spent a year in prison and be done with it. I mean, it seems like you could even make a practical case for it rather than, you know, this hanging over their heads is such a burden that it might be even easier to just go to prison.
Right.
So,
I can't speak for the soldiers, but I can speak to reality, which is that certainly that's something that they've all thought about at this point. You know, it's kind of like, you know. So some of them have gone back. Kyle Snyder actually brokered a deal with his commander and returned to Colorado Springs to submit himself for potential incarceration. And it became clear when he delivered himself into custody that that in fact the deal that had been brokered was null and void, that it wasn't going to be honored, and so he returned to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Darren, I'm trying to think of his last name, who wasn't in the film, but he received a Purple Heart in Iraq. He went back and decided to just serve out his time. And certainly I think if Jeremy hadn't been the first case and kind of the lightning rod case, I suspect he would have gone back as well. But at this point, he's so far into it, and he's a very conscientious person, very thoughtful, very bright. I think he decided quite some time ago that he would, you know, he would be the one to take this through and to just at least, you know, raise the visibility of the issue through being kind of the guinea pig.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if it wasn't, if he didn't have two kids, he probably would have gone to prison a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think because he has a family, he's made some different choices. And there's no guarantee he would just get a year, right? Like it's the commander of the base that determines it. There's no sort of like, you're at the mercy of whoever the commander on duty is when you return.
Right. Just to go back to something, I just want to be clear on the issue of the war's illegality. I mean, it seems to me that there are two separate issues here. One is if you're simply a conscientious objector, or you, if you simply leave the army and move to Canada, you are not under Canadian law considered a refugee. Is that a fair assessment of the situation?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
Probably not. It seems to me, as I'm understanding it, there are sort of two facets to this. The first is
how do we define refugee?
Is what,
right?
Well, I guess. I mean, the argument is a person who leaves the army while still technically in the army and moves to Canada doesn't enjoy refugee status unless certain conditions are met. Is that a fair...
No, I would say that that legally it doesn't have anything to do with their status as being soldiers, deserters, anything like that. I think what the presiding immigration officers and subsequently judges have determined is that the assumption is made that because, especially if you look at the court findings, because these people who are submitting refugee claims come from the United States of America, which is, you know, a great social democracy, the assumption is made that they must have some kind of legal recourse in the United States, that they could take this to the various, you know, levels of the judiciary available in the United States. The reality is not so. Or if there is any opportunity for that, how does one find the proper legal representation? How do they pay for it? How does one find their way to these kinds of things? And in the case of many soldiers, they have been able to find their way to the kinds of organizations down there that do this kind of work. But, you know, most kids that enlist in the military, I mean, some of them enlist when they're 16, right? JROTC and stuff. So, you know, they don't have a lot of life experience. They don't know that they have rights. They don't know that there are people out there who can support them. They don't even know that there's such a thing as conscientious objection. I mean, you know, my husband, who graduated with honors from Boston University, only found out about that you could file as a CO by reading the history of the Vietnam War while he was convalescing from a back operation. You know, it's not information that's readily available. You need to know about it, so then you need to be able to know where to go look for it. So this issue of, like, how do we define a refugee here in Canada, well, that's certainly been the boondoggle to their case, right, particularly because they're from the United States, not from, you know, North Korea or Iran or something, right? So that's one part of it. And then you had a second piece that you wanted to ask.
So if I go to Canada and say I want to become a Canadian, why would the default option be deporting these people, I guess is what I'm trying to understand.
Right. Well, because, you know, refugee claim is based on persecution, right? And so, so it's determined, you know, what's the risk? If you were, you know, returned to Somalia, let's say, are you going to be tortured, imprisoned, and how, you know, how reasonable a response in your home country is it to whatever course of action you took? Well, in the case of American war resistors, you know, are they going to be persecuted? Well, no, you know. So how do you then establish a refugee claim? Well, what their lawyers have been arguing all along is that, well, if you're going to make this case about they come from a social democracy, so they can't possibly be refugees, then you have to look at the issue of prosecution. And in a social democracy, is prosecution equivalent to persecution?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the you know, other legal tacks that the lawyers here in Canada have been taking on the behalf of the war resisters.
So the default position is that almost by definition you cannot be a refugee from the United States.
Right.
Okay. And so therefore,
because each of the judges are like, well, you know, why aren't they doing this in the courts of America?
Right. The same question I asked. Why didn't they file their CO claim? Why didn't they fight it in the courts? Those kind of things. But so
right.
That,
well,
so,
if you talk to soldiers down there who are trying to do that, you'll get a pretty clear picture of how challenging, you know, it's as challenging, if not more so, than what people are doing in Canada.
I guess you feel better, though, if somebody files a CO claim and it gets rejected or lost, and they file another one and it gets rejected or lost or whatever, and you know, they've gone through their options. You know, they've basically exhausted all possibilities before taking an extreme measure. But, you know,
right.
as you said,
which is what, you know, Hinsman did, but
right.
The other three, no. I mean, you know, the other two didn't come into their consciences until they were on the ground in Iraq, and, you know, the nature of what was happening on the ground is, you know, sort of haunt them, right? So, and in the case of Brandon Huey, I think it had a lot to do with, you know, his age and his idealism. You know, he sort of enlisted thinking, you know, after 9/11 he was going to go protect and save his country, and he really believed in that. And then when this thing happened with his signing bonus, he, you know, creates this atmosphere of mistrust. Like, it's like, well, wait a second, why is a person in uniform not following through on what was promised in my contract? And then, you know, he started to, you know, it's a process, right? It's, you know, he started to think about, you know, then they find out that there are no weapons of mass destruction, and so, you know, the reasons he thought he was going to fight over there are proving false, and, you know, he came to really question just what exactly he was going over there to serve, like a lot of soldiers. And, you know, one of the most interesting things I heard, you know, talking to other soldiers who did go and came back is I had quite a number of them say to me, well, I wish I had the courage those guys did.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, now I have to live with what I did, right?
You mentioned the issue with the paperwork and the signing bonus, and there was that moment and the moment where I'm terrible with names, but the one talks about being outside of the city hall and the guy never coming out. Those were two moments.
Yes.
Those were two moments when I thought that, well, I don't really have any reason to trust this guy. There's no corroboration. It's just his word against nothing.
That's right.
And I know that was challenging, not getting the Pentagon to talk to you. But why include those things when, for me, it's not credible? And I would say they're incredible in the technical definition of the word, not credible to me, those claims. And it seems like I don't think that's fair, because I have no reason to think that, I have no reason to know that this guy is telling the truth, or that his memory is not warped, or that, you know, he misunderstood something.
Or that even in the confusion of battle and things like that, right? Like, you know, the scene of an accident, people have...
Right, you know, there's a back exit to the city hall, whatever. But
right.
As an editor, and you're a former journalist, so, you know, as an editor, I would, if that claim weren't a story, I would take that out, because there's no way, it's an unknowable, the actual
right.
situation is unknowable without evidence. So the question I'm asking you is, why leave those things in? Because
why leave those things in? Because I'm not a journalist anymore. I'm a point of view documentary filmmaker. And because this is about hearing what they have to say. You'll notice there's no narration in the film,
mm-hmm.
right? My voice isn't in the film. It's just their four stories woven together, and the audience makes up their mind on what they've heard. And that seemed to be the best way through, you know, such a political minefield, you know, because I, you know, I respect my audience, and, you know, I don't want to be shoving anything down their throat. But certainly if one of the soldiers in the film is saying, well, this is the reason I deserted, I'm going to include it, you know. And anytime I've spoken about the film, I've been very careful you know, when speaking of that particular scenario, or even even Jeremy's claim that his, you know, CO application was lost. You know, those are allegations, right? It's their word against, you know, the military, and unfortunately, the military refused to speak to me.
Right. So you say your voice wasn't in it, but you include some, frankly, loaded images. There's the mission accomplished bit with George, and then there's the training.
Why is that loaded?
From my perspective, for me personally, it's a cliche. I think I've seen it hundreds of times now. It's a joke. It's, yeah, I got it. George Bush is an idiot. I don't really care about that.
Well, no, it's actually very important if you follow the legal, because the war was said to be over at that point. So suddenly their status changes when it comes to, for instance, your question about the death penalty and stuff, right? So it's actually
that's a fair point. If that were made clear, but it placed at the front of the movie as it is, it seems, and when I say loaded, I mean there's so much cultural baggage with that moment.
Well, I'm from a different culture, too.
Well, we've seen it.
So, you're having a very emotional response to it. To me, it's just a fact. It's, you know, it's what happened. And,
that's very interesting.
It gives us a mark in time of, you know, when these guys got sent over.
Okay, that's a valid point. So the other one that I wanted to ask about in terms of your voice is the, I'm guessing it's footage of training with a kill, 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 kill.
That was very surprising to me that that's what actually goes on during training. So that's why I wanted to show that to the audience.
Where'd that footage come from?
That came from a film, what's the name of the film, that won Hot Docs. It was a film on recruitment after 9/11. I'm sorry, I'll have to look it up while we're talking. But, that was someone who had access, to the military. It's a, you know, bona fide, well-funded documentary and stuff. And the reason I included that is because of Jeremy's narrative, where he said that, you know, as he was being indoctrinated into the military, you know, as you know, part of military training is, and, you know, this firsthand from my husband is, you know, you remove the person's sort of what's sort of layperson's identity, right? You shave their head, you give them dog tags, and you know it's actually not natural for people to kill. We have to be trained how to do it so we don't lose sleep at night and feel sick to our stomach. You know, for some people that's easier than for others. In Jeremy's case, he was a tough guy, he was very physically strong, very mentally astute, was on his way to Ranger School, and the indoctrination wasn't working for him. He wasn't finding it easier as, you know, the shape of the target for training morphed from just a regular bullseye into a human torso. These things bothered him. Most soldiers you talk to, even those who don't become conscientious objectors say that, you know, the bayonet training is one of the hardest parts, right? Because it's hand-to-hand combat training, and it's disturbing, you know, you're poking this thing into someone's stomach. So I just wanted to be very real about what goes on in military training and why it is that someone like Jeremy, who was on this great career path within the military, took such a turn, you know, and it was because of that kind of stuff. He says in the film, I mean, he says, I felt like I was being turned into an animal, you know, go sick him or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think that footage shows very clearly that this is in fact what goes on, and it doesn't work for everybody.
Is it typical? I mean, I guess...
Yes. Ask my husband, and you should hear some of the chants that go on. And I mean, I think this is important for people to know, right? It's not even I'm not even condemning it. I'm just saying if we're going to talk about this stuff, mm-hmm. if we're going to look at what it really means for a soldier to give over his or herself to this higher cause, you know, let's get real about what that means, what it looks like, and why it is then that when some of these soldiers come home, you know, they need a lot of psychological help, they're disturbed, and for those that can't kill, you know, they're supposed to have a right to that conscience. In fact, Jeremy didn't even want to get a discharge. He wanted to be a non-combatant.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
So the question, the reason that bothered me is because I don't have the context to know whether that's typical or an aberration.
Filmed on a military base, so you decide, right?
Well,
I mean, it obviously goes on. There it is.
Well, it went on once when it was photographed. I mean, that's if I'm skeptical, I'm going to say, well, how do I know if that's a typical type of chant? Or I guess the question I was asking before about you have an hour, you're doing it for television, what did you want to increase? Is there a way to have provided that context so you have a sense of whether this is what goes on all the time or this is just what happened once?
Well, I think that's a fair question, and I think that's a challenge of not narrating something.
Mm-hmm.
Right? From an editorial perspective, I think it's consistent. You know, it enables, you know, people can see it and they can make of it what they will. And people, yeah, they're often surprised to learn what basic training really involves.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing that we send people off to war, whether it's Canada, the U.S., whatever, and then we don't want to look at what really goes on in war, you know? And where does that leave our soldiers, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, war is about killing, bottom line. And are we okay with that? And if we are, then, you know, how are we going to support our soldiers around that,
mm-hmm.
you know, in every way possible? You know, those are the questions that are really at the heart of this film. You know, I'm not even making any claims about, I don't even bring up the international piece of the illegality of the war piece. You know, that just emerges out of the context of what these guys are grappling with as they sort of navigate this political minefield, you know. But at the end of the day, this is about what kind of society we're creating, and if that society is going to be predicated on foreign wars for whatever motives, we need to really look at what we're asking our young people to do, and in whose name, and what exactly we're asking them to carry out, and what kind of actions they need to take within, you know, for that cause, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people everywhere like to argue about what the cause is in Iraq, and that's obviously been a huge factor as to why so many soldiers, you know, have deserted and are having psychological issues. Right? It's not a very, you know, the mission is encumbered.
Mm-hmm.
So all the more reason to look very closely at what our soldiers are doing on the ground.
Do you plan on following up with this in terms of doing a filmed follow-up to kind of deal with the resolution of these cases?
No, I'm not planning to do that.
Mm-hmm.
The film is really, you know, what it is, just mm-hmm. looking at these. It's really a film about conscientious. About conscience, right?
Mm-hmm.
About the individual's responsibility and rights. And you know, there are other films about other aspects of that war. This is just really, you know, taking it right down to the individual, taking it right down to the foot soldier on the ground that has to carry out these orders.